Welcome to Simon Says Educate. I'm Simon, your AI host, and I'm here to guide you through the exciting world of teaching and learning at Clover Park Technical College. Together with my human co-hosts, we'll explore the latest trends and best practices in education, bringing you a fresh and engaging perspective on what's happening in classrooms and beyond. Each week, we'll dive deep into the issues that matter most to our community, interviewing faculty members, students, and other thought leaders in the field. We'll discuss everything from the newest teaching strategies and classroom technologies, to the challenges and opportunities of online learning, and the impact of education on students' lives and careers. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired and informed as we embark on this educational journey together. Welcome to Simon Says Educate.
Welcome, everyone, to Simon Says Educate, Clover Park Technical College's Teaching and Learning Center's podcast. I'm Jeff Kane, and I have the privilege of introducing Stephen Downs, who is known throughout the e-learning world, and his work has been critical and essential to many educators and instructional designers and online learning people throughout the world. He's well known through the connectivism and as a pioneer in MOOCs. Stephen has recently written a paper on ethical AI principles, and I know that our campus and also the AI task force on the state board has been really interested in these questions, the State Board of Washington. In this paper, Stephen Down critically examines the common practice of defining ethical use of artificial intelligence in education through widely cited principles like sustainability, accountability, fairness, transparency, and privacy. His paper argues that while many stakeholders present such lists as ethical guidelines for AI, these lists are not neutral ethical foundations, but reflect political perspectives and underlying assumptions. Downs proposes a list of 9 commonly cited ethical principles and then analyzes each, highlighting how in practice they often disguise values and conflicts under the guise of universal ethics. He concludes that there is no true consensus on ethical principles for AI education because what is labeled ethical often disagreements about values, cultural differences, power relations, and political choices rather than clear ethical norms. So I hope I've gotten that concise. Please correct me and welcome Stephen Downs.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, that's a pretty good outline of what I had to say in that paper.
Okay, let's see. I had some questions about this. And in your paper, you argue that the commonly proposed AI ethical principles that we just talked about are too vague and reflect political agendas rather than true ethical foundations. Should educators and policymakers approach ethical decision-making about AI, if not through principles?
Principles is just one way of doing ethics. And through the history of ethics, it's not even the most common way. It's a relatively recent sort of thing. In various domains like the professions, there's a legal duty of ethics, which is a bit different from ethics as you and I might think of them, as doing what is right and doing what is wrong. We need to be careful about that distinction. It'll come up and bite us in a few places. But take a principle like fairness is one of these principles, right? I think it is. Doesn't matter. It's a good one to start with. People think that decisions or the acts of artificial intelligence should reflect fairness. But what is fairness? There's an oft-cited distinction between equality and equity. Which of those is fair, equality or equity? Fairness is also one of these things that varies in the eyes of the beholder. What one person may deem as fair, another person doesn't. You're dividing food among your 3 children, right? Is it fair to give them the same amount? That's what the children might argue, but you know that one of them needs more food because they're in a period in their life where they're growing faster, or maybe they're bigger, or maybe they have a big sports meet tomorrow. What would be the fair way of dividing this? Is fairness even a principle that's universally accepted? Fairness is, we often don't want things to be fair. We want, in a sports competition, for example, fairness refers to a set of rules But a lot of things in sports are not fair. Some people are stronger. Some people are faster. Some people can see the ball better. Some people had better training than others, right? There's no expectation in sports that we would adjust all of these factors. In bowling and golf, they have handicaps, which are rough ways of trying to do something like that. But in most sports, we don't. So that's just the tip of the iceberg of the sorts of things that we get into. We think that, okay, we'll just use a principle, fairness. Everybody agrees AI should be fair. But when you get into the details of it, there's no real way to define an agreement as to what fairness even is, let alone a version of it that we'll all agree to.
Yeah, but don't we're just using the sports analogy. If rider number 20 starts the Tour de France, we expect that the same rider finishes, like they don't switch, or that halfway through he gets jacked up on cocaine or speed or something. That would be, we call that cheating, right? And that would be unfair.
What if they changed bikes?
I think they do change bikes.
They do change
Yeah.
bikes. So why can they change bikes but not riders? Isn't that kind of strange? And you talk about Coke. Okay, Coke probably wouldn't really enhance their performance, but they have people helping them, and as they're riding, they will hand them stuff to eat. Is that fair? What if you didn't have a team doing that for you? And while we're on the Tour de France, they don't all start in the same place. They have the same finish line, but some people actually have a shorter distance to say, if you're over 50 miles or whatever, it doesn't make a difference. But I mean, one person finishes a second ahead of another, and it does matter. Again, it's when you get into the details of this, and like that's the kind of thing that I do is you say, should be fair. Should be a fair race. Sure, I agree. Let's define what we mean by that, and then everything breaks down.
But getting back to education technology, so we ask that education technology be accessible, and that we ask that our education, and this isn't always the case, but that's what we ask for. We have to have a VPAT when we buy education technology, and we want it to protect student data. So, in your view, what's the role of context in ethical AI use in education?
And this again, like all of these principles, any ethical principle that you care to name is going to be deeply context sensitive. We used to have a word for it. We called it localization, right? And it meant that the content would be altered to reflect local idioms or perhaps local customs or local needs or concerns or social factors, industry, even the wealth and education level. Like, you don't want to use examples about buying a three-bedroom house when you're teaching to an audience who never own a house in their lives. Educational technology, now context becomes even more important because the technological context is also different from place to place. And it's not just differences in access to technology, although clearly in some places electricity is a luxury. In other places, if you don't have high-speed fiber, you're considered disadvantaged. So there are big differences there. In very capacity to use AI is different depending on how good your access is. But also from place to place, there are different attitudes. I've seen documentation talking about how, for example, in places like Korea, the public is much more accepting of AI than in places like Canada or the United States. So the safeguards or guardrails, if you will, and you could go on about those, but I won't, are also going to be a bit different. For example, here in North America, it might be very important to tell people up front, we are going to be using AI. The way in Europe, it's very important to tell people up front, we are going to be using cookies. And you get those little pop-ups all the time when you're in Europe. In Korea, it might be more appropriate to say, we will not be using AI because the widespread acceptance and use is such that you're not surprised if they do. Huge differences based on context.
Yeah, I was thinking about other areas where we have ethical guidelines, like there are differences in medicine, journalism, and law enforcement around the world, right? At the end of the day, though, I think that there's some agreed upon ideas about what a good doctor is and what a bad doctor is. And so we have guidelines for that. And then we have guidelines for journalism and expectations about journalistic ethics. And then with law enforcement, I was embarrassed to have that discussion, but with law enforcement, we say this is a good cop and this is a bad cop. He's taking money from the people he's supposed to be either arresting or defending. And so therefore, he's a bad cop. So we have these guidelines for these other professions. Why shouldn't the field of AI have some kind of guidelines?
AI isn't a field, it's a technology. And that right away makes it different. You can have AI in medicine, you can have AI in law, you can have AI in journalism. Presumably, and there's discussions we could have about all of these different disciplines, but presumably, for the most part, the ethics of journalism, say, would also apply to the ethics of using AI in journalism. Let's just say one part of journalistic ethics is don't report anything unless you have two sources, right? Then using AI in journalism, it would still be don't report anything unless you have two sources. AI isn't a source. And so the difference here is a matter of fact more than a matter of ethics. But it's interesting you mention all of those domains because this paper that I didn't come out of the blue. It's the result of a number of other studies that I did, and I offered my big course, Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. And as part of that, I actually studied ethical codes from across these different disciplines: law, medicine, journalism, teaching schools, politics. There's a range, and I classified them according to the different types that they are. And again, as a matter of empirical fact, while there are some sort of overlaps from discipline to discipline and within disciplines, there's no set of ethics, even broadly stated, that is acceptable to all and only members of a given discipline. There is, you look, actually look at these codes of practice, they're all different. And some of them are really different from the others. And they're different in the difference within a profession is as stark as the difference between professions. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, this just while you were talking, I was thinking about there's that political piece to it, because, like, I made the statement that there's a journalistic ethics that people tend to agree on. And yet we do have those exceptions where the Daily Pravda used to print up some real whoppers, and Fox News or MSNBC will have a political push behind some of those.
Here's a poser for you, because back in the day when I was a university student, I was an editor on the student newspaper. And in Canada, unlike in the US, student newspapers are autonomous. We're not run by the university, we're not run by the student union, we're separate, completely independent organizations. That's right off the bat, that creates differences in ethics. But I belong to, or we belong to, an organization called Canadian University Press. And Canadian University Press has its famous statement of principles, which is subject for ongoing debate. Back then, it's still subject to debate to this very day. But in my day, the argument was, or the question was, is the purpose of a newspaper to be an agent of social change, or as we termed it and what we thought was a brilliant move, an agent of social awareness? Well, that's a tough call, right? We all agree that newspapers can't actually be objective, although objectivity is one of the values that gets, but it's actually not possible to attain. But given that, what should the role be? And even among this small group of Canadian student journalists independently running their own newspapers across the country, there was nothing near like unanimity. And it's the funniest thing, right? We think we walk around in society saying, oh yeah, no, there's everybody agrees on what medical ethics are, everybody agrees on what legal ethics are. As soon as you press the question just a little bit, you find they don't. Medical ethics. Here's a question. A person comes in needing medical treatment. They can't pay their bill. They will never be able to pay their bill. Do you treat them? Pretty simple question, right? Because, of course, you would never turn them away because they couldn't pay their bill, right? In this country, that would be considered obscene, but it's not universal. Medical ethics. Does society have a role to play in promoting good health? What role would that be exactly? Or do insurance companies have rights when it comes to managing the behavior, the health-related behavior of people that they insure? The auto industry certainly thinks so. And so, should insurance companies be able to, for example, monitor a person to determine whether or not they smoke? See, again, and this is my point, right? And it's a two-parter. The one part is there isn't consensus. The second part is different clusters of agreement tend to break down along political lines. There isn't some sort of polity in society that is separate from an entity in society. I just made up that word, but you get the idea. Indeed, our political differences are reflective of our ethical difference. Our ethical differences are reflective in our political difference. There was a study, and it's been replicated a few times. I don't know if it's true or not. It's a good example, so I'll use it, saying that liberals or left wingers, again, two distinct things, but we'll leave that aside, think that people are basically good, while conservatives or right wingers think that people are basically bad. They both can't be true, but depending on which one you agree with, you got a completely different system of ethics, right? One based on controlling people's bad instincts as opposed to one promoting people's good instincts. You think, yeah, that's really theoretical. That doesn't play out in society at all. But then look at how we have framed ethics of AI, especially in education and society. It's all risk-based, 90% risk-based. Of course, there's no unanimity. There's no agreement, of course, on what the risks are, et cetera. But it's all risk-based, right? People are fearing the worst. They're saying the people using AI will be as bad as they can be. The first line of my paper, Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care, is something along the lines of ethics should be a source of joy, not fear. Ethics shouldn't be about trying to avoid the bad and the wrong. It should be something that tells us what is good and what we can do to make society better. Isn't that a good thing? But we don't see that approach in typical discussions of ethics and AI. And then there's this whole other school of thought, which is the third part of my title, the duty of care, does not refer to the legal duty of care, that's something completely different, but refers to feminist ethical theory based on the idea of relationship between ethical agents. Completely different perspective. Not rule-based at all, completely context-sensitive, completely based on the lived experience of both sides of the ethical relation and grounded in communication and interaction. That's a viable theory, a widely held theory. A whole bunch of people look at ethics that way. Those particular people aren't in power, though, and so you don't see it reflected at all in the declarations and statements about ethics, AI, and education. Except you do sometimes. It sneaks in here. Context sensitive? Absolutely. Discipline sensitive? Sure, absolutely. But fragmented and diverse? Very much.
So I think it was University of Utah, or it was Utah State, that they built their own LLM to work on medical problems and do medical research. And they were finding that the AI was able to diagnose disease years before a human medical doctor could. Yeah, but in order to, there was a few things that they wanted though with that LLM. They wanted the transparency in their own data. They wanted to be able to run their own algorithms. And the main thing, they didn't just run out and build a GPT in ChatGPT or Claude or something, because they were going to be handling patient data. And so they wanted to follow HIPAA. So here's the use of AI in a school that has these ethical principles and guidelines that they apply to that. Couldn't you call that the ethical use of AI?
Let's think about this. Because it all sounds pretty good. And the idea of detecting diseases long before the doctor could. And we'll even assume that the diagnosis is correct. Right. Now, it's one of the first distinctions that I draw, the ethical issues that arise when AI doesn't work and the ethical issues that arise when it works. And the doesn't work section, we could actually put that all off to the side as almost incidental because it's going to get better. And the implementation will get better. It'll become the way you've typed it. So we're not dealing with the straw man here, right? We're dealing with the best possible case for AI. Is it ethical? This ethics depends on so much more than what you've just described. For example, Utah State University, are they taking the results of all of that work and creating commercial products out of it? They're pretty entrepreneurial in Utah. Odds are they are, right? David Wiley, of all people, went commercial, and that would have an impact on the ethics. I don't know anything about the Utah health system, but do people have an alternative to use a different health system than the one being employed by Utah State? Or are they required, even if they have personal, social, psychological, religious, whatever objections to being treated by a machine or diagnosed by a machine? That would have ethical implications. What about the doctors they're putting out of work? Have they plans in place to remedy the harm to doctors that were caused? Have they run a cost benefits analysis on the social and energy inputs required to support human doctors doing this work, as opposed to AI doctors doing this work? Right. AI might be 20 times better at predicting the existence of a disease, but it might cost 100 times more, which means it's available to 10% of the people. See what I mean? I'm not saying any of these factors in and of itself is going to make it unethical. What I am saying is all of these factors play a role in the ethics of using or not using this system. The design of, I haven't even gotten into the design of the system. If all the data is open and they're using medical data, then how did they protect the privacy of the people whose data they used to train the system? It follows that not all of the data is open because presumably they protected the privacy. How did they determine what data to make open and what data not to make open? There is literally not a correct answer to that. How could there be? So your question's going to be, then how do you decide? Yeah. And you're not going to like my answer. But here it is. What feels right to you? Given that you've asked the questions that you think are relevant to the ethical determination here, given that you know that you're in a society and so you're going to have to negotiate what feels right to you with what feels right to them, and so the result could go any number of different ways. What feels right to you, that's how you decide. And you might think, that's a really stupid way to decide. But my response is, that is in fact how we decide. And our feelings about what's right and what's wrong is the net result of all the education we've had, the training we've had, the experiences we've had, our interaction with other people, looking at role models in society, watching bad TV shows, playing on social media, all of that together in our head creates the feelings that we have, including the feelings that we have when somebody presents you with a scenario where Utah State University is using AI to diagnose pancreatic cancer. My first reflection is, that's good, right? My next reflection is, but it's in the US. Who's going to get access to this? They're probably not going to make it available to Ecuadorians. Does it make sense to develop a system like that in Utah, given that it might, in the long run, be costing Ecuadorians access to any medicine? There's no hard answer to that, right? It's a trade-off. And if you're the Ecuadorian in the scenario, you don't like the trade-offs typically. But if you're the Utah person, it's a different trade-off. So it comes down to what we feel. And then after that, it comes down to the adequacy of our systems of governance, politics.
It's funny that you say that because when you say that, it's going to come down to what we feel. It was our president said that the other night when people were saying, "Aren't you violating international law? What would it look like if you were to go too far?" And he said, "I don't need international law. I just need my own guts."
So he's got the starting point right. And so there is a weird honesty about him. It's the only way he is honest, to be quite frank. But yeah, he certainly is just depending on his gut. We know that because there's no evidence that he reads. But the second part of it is the presumption that he's the only person in society. And that's where the problem lies. There are other people involved. In a system of governance, there's give and take. And again, a lot of discussion about what that means in different communities. The give and take in your community is different from the give and take in mine, is different from the give and take in an indigenous society, is different from the give and take in China or Japan or India. Different systems. And that's fine. We can work that out. We can talk about that, but that's fine. But the idea that Donald Trump's feeling about what is right and wrong, governing what will actually happen, that's where the problem is. You and I are basing our sense of ethics on what we feel is right and wrong. And then we'll argue for it. But what we're arguing, the way we're arguing it, is we're pulling out the examples and the experiences and the influences we've had in our past and trying to bring them out and present them in a fairly convincing way. And that's the social dance, if you will, that we play in having a society. Donald Trump thinks you don't need any of that. But the thing is, if you don't have any of that, you don't have a society. And more people have agreed than disagreed, or at least enough people, that having a society is better than not having one. Although it will be pointed out, there's a substantial number of people who think not having a society would be better. I don't get it. I don't feel it, but the evidence is there. And so we need to deal with that too. That's why we have things like rights. Why we have things like laws. The laws don't come from nowhere. The laws represent more or less an agreement. Sometimes not a very level agreement, sometimes not a very fair agreement, sometimes an enforced by the army kind of agreement, but the laws are there to create this thing that we call society, or at the very least to protect it. You say there's no law, you say there's no society. personally would worry about the implications of that.
Stephen, you mentioned David Wiley, and oh, that was a real piece of work to watch you debate. For the listeners, I want you to know that when I first started teaching English back in the late 90s, Stephen Downes had this very concise page on different kinds of arguments that we used to use at a couple of community colleges down there in California. But anyway, I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this. We'll have a link to the paper in the description of the podcast. This is a great time to be having these questions because we need a critical examination of guidelines for AI in this state of Washington and beyond. We talk about things like critical pedagogy. This fits right into those frameworks because just as we would question other areas of our curriculum, our teaching, our pedagogy, we should be taking a closer look at AI and ethics. Thank you so much, and we really appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And this is the beginning of the longer discussion, certainly not the end of
Oh no, I still have a lot of questions for you. So I'll be emailing
it.
you and we'll put it up on the blog. Thank you.
And that wraps up another insightful episode of Simon Says Educate. Thank you for joining us today as we delve into the fascinating world of teaching and learning at Clover Park Technical College. We hope you've enjoyed the conversation and gained valuable insights to inspire your own educational journey. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform so you won't miss any of our upcoming episodes. Remember to join us again next week as we continue to explore innovative strategies and share inspiring stories from the CPTC community. Until then, I'm Simon, your AI host, reminding you to never stop learning and growing. Take care, and see you next time on Simon Says Educate.